Okay, this is the premiere episode of Not Another Sports Show on WRFU-LP Urbana FM 104.5. Before we start things off, I should let you know about our disclaimer. WRFU is an open forum for the Urbana-Champaign community. Views expressed are those of the speakers and are not intended to represent WRFU, the UCIMC, or the Urbana Socialist Forum. As our premiere episode, we were going to start things off by talking about why progressives should be interested in sports and sports news. We also have special guests with us, Lori Serb and Caroline Napo from the Graduate Employees Organization, and they'll be talking about their recent activities and the strike on campus, and we'll be following things up with what we hope to be a regular segment, Better Know an Owner. So I'm your co-host, Damian Matthew. I'm here with my other co-host, Neil Parthen. Neil, why should progressives be interested in sports news?
Well, it's great to have the discounted price to my Sarah Palin's Going Rogue here with me in the studio.
That would be me. Yeah.
progressives, you know, normally don't think of sports as a venue where their ideas can be taken seriously or why they should care. In fact, Noam Chomsky is quite virulent about sports having no goal in social society. And I really heartily disagree with Mr. Chomsky on this issue. Very famously, in 1968, we've all seen the picture of Tommy Smith and John Carlos at the Olympics, and with their hands outstretched. However, not many people know why they were protesting. A lot of people just attribute it to the 1960s, and that being a very difficult time of a lot of social upheaval. The thing was, they were also not only protesting against racism, they were trying to get the head of the International Olympic Committee, Avery Brundage, fired because he was supporting two apartheid teams. And so they politicized a lot of what was going on with sports. And fortunately, people also don't know that Peter Norman, the Australian silver medalist, it was actually his gloves that they borrowed. And when he found out what they were going to do, he ran over and grabbed an Olympic Project for Human Rights button and put it on.
Interesting.
Oh, when you go over to issues of race, we all know 1947, Jackie Robinson breaks the color barrier. However, people don't know that Larry Doby broke the color barrier in the American League. Althea Gibson breaks the color barrier in the 1950s in tennis. Roberto Clemente starts breaking color barriers and breaking race barriers with the Pittsburgh Pirates in the 1960s. There's even modern-day issues of disparity in media treatment and also police treatment of white athletes in comparison to black athletes that can be highly politicized. With the history of women, suffragettes started talking about bicycling and sport to be one of the means of emancipation. Babe Didrikson, a very famous golfer from the 1950s, worked a whole lot towards issues of women's emancipation, and when she was asked any sports that she didn't play because she dominated almost every sport that she did play, her answer was very quickly, "Yeah, I don't play dolls."
Nice.
The advent of Title IX helping to create numerous women's sports inside of America that end up helping out teens with all sorts of different things. Access to sports means that they're more likely to get better grades, studies have proven, less likely to do drugs, less likely to be sexually promiscuous, less likely to have a whole lot of negative things. More positive body image can come from sports, so they're also involved with women. When it comes to gay rights, very famously, the famous tennis player Margarita Navratilova, in the 80s, when it wasn't a very posh movement as it is more nowadays, she very famously had her partner sitting in the family section at every tournament that she was playing in. Just recently, with the National Equality March, the Baltimore Ravens linebacker Brendan Ibadejo came out in support of gay marriage, saying that in 10, 20, or 30 years, we'll all sit back and wonder why gays and lesbians didn't have the same kind of rights that everybody else had. And also New Orleans Saints defender Scott Fujita came out openly in support of the National Equality March. When it comes to labor rights, there's a whole history of the Reserve Clause and the fight for free agency that's been taking place. Back up until the 1970s, in every major sport, there was a reserve clause, which meant that you could be owned by that team for a one-year contract in perpetuity. The NFL Players Association, the MLB Players Association, their fight for higher wages and better workplaces. The NBA referees, which were recently locked out by David Stern during contract negotiations. the Players Association's coming out for support of the Employee Free Choice Act, and you always have owners threatening to move teams and cut salaries to hold taxpayers hostage for taxpayer subsidies for stadiums.
Of course. So, all very good reasons why progressives should be interested in sports news and all the progressive issues that are surrounded with them, right?
Well, yeah, and for all those people that don't think sports and politics mix, you don't have to believe in gravity to fall out of an airplane either.
I love it. Okay, so we've been thinking about starting off most of our shows with news of the week. What do you got for us, Neil?
This week we have quite a few news stories. Number one, the NFL Players Association is investigating Eric Mangini and the Cleveland Browns. The NFL Players Association is trying to set up meetings with Browns players this week to talk about Eric Mangini's practices after a person had told the union about dangerous issues of overwork and safety. Two Browns players have already been injured during post-practice drills that Mangini calls, quote, opportunity periods. A member of Cleveland's practice squad, defensive and Keith Grennan, hurt his knee on one such drill, and their rookie running back that was drafted this season, James Davis, went on injured reserve last month with a season-ending shoulder surgery.
I wonder what he means by opportunity periods, like opportunity for experience or opportunity for, I mean, in this case, it sounds like opportunity for injury.
Yes, he proclaims that they're opportunity advancements that you can join the main team from a practice squad.
Ah, okay, I gotcha. Now, this next one actually sounds really interesting, the Ole Miss story. What's the deal with that?
Ole Miss has finally gotten rid of their tradition of having a line that the South will rise again during their team fight song. The chancellor made this move, which I heartily applaud, and the university has shortened the song to try to discourage the students from yelling the South will rise again at the end of it. And this move has inspired students to yell the South will rise again at the end of the shortened song. The school got rid of the mascot Colonel Rebel 6 years ago and forbade the waving of the Confederate battle flag to distance itself from its past, which includes 1962 riots over the admission of its first black students. In the aftermath, a YouTube video containing racial slurs and profanity led to the suspension of one member and expulsion of another member of the university's Delta Gamma chapter of Phi Kappa Tau after the Ole Miss Rush chair, a student named Michael Hudek, was stated as, quote, F those N's, and I'll let you fill in the blanks.
That's just awful.
In response to people pushing Ole Miss to get rid of the South will rise again at games. Maybe this will help get through to him. Moron today. Moron tomorrow. Moron forever.
Oh my God. And so there's been some interesting repercussions to this, right? Should we go into the most recent developments around this story?
Oh, why not, Damien? Which group is coming to help defend Mr. Hudek and the original traditional song?
You guessed it, the KKK?
Yes, the Ku Klux Klan is actually coming out to protest against the university at today's game versus Louisiana State University.
That's amazing. I wonder if they're actually a registered student organization down there.
That may very well be a possibility.
That is very odd. Very odd indeed.
Now, Damien, there was also an incident that happened last week with Bud Adams, the owner of the Tennessee Titans, if you wouldn't mind telling us about what happened there.
Well, what I have is that he apparently was celebrating a recent win with perhaps a little bit more enthusiasm than he probably should have. He apparently extended his middle digit from both arms repeatedly and was apparently fined $250,000 for this rather enthusiastic gesture in support of his team.
It should be noted that this man is 86 years old. And the
Good
YouTube
point.
Video of this is quite possibly one of the funniest things because he's also dancing while he's doing it.
It's very funny to watch, very amusing. A very happy old man who perhaps made an ill-advised gesture.
And it's a kind of unfortunate. A lot of people are saying, you know, oh, this is terrible. Every fan does that. He just happened to be caught on tape doing it, and he's an owner, so he's supposed to be held to some sort of higher standard.
Right. He's the owner. He should know that there's cameras pointed at him, and, you know, I mean, he should probably be. But then again, I mean, yeah, his team won.
Yeah. And he was very happy about it. More power to him for being pressuring the head coach to start Vince Young, and they're 3-0 since doing it. So a couple of middle fingers, and, you know, he probably pulled that money out of underneath his mattress, and you know, nobody's going
to
notice.
Yeah, like, $250,000 is nothing to the guy. Okay, our next segment will include our special guests. We're going to tie this in the recent activity that the Graduate Employees Organization has had with some of the budgetary priorities at the U of I, and in particular with the athletics program. Is that correct, Neil?
Yes. There was just a couple other news stories that you kind of skipped over a little
bit. Oh, I'm sorry.
Hey, it's our first show, so...
Yeah, what's going on here? Okay, yeah, tell us more news.
The New York Mets, as of tomorrow, are facing a whole storm of controversy because they're allowing the Hebron Fund, a Brooklyn-based nonprofit...
Oh, that's right.
...to
this is interesting.
Hold a fundraiser at Citi Field, or as I call it, since we've owned parts of Citi. It's the stadium that taxpayers built. In a tragic irony, the Hebron Fund dinner is being held directly above the Jackie Robinson Rotunda at Citi Field. The Hebron Fund, for those of you who don't know, supports the Israeli settlements in the Israeli-occupied West Bank, which violates international law. The Hebron Fund helps to support numerous violent acts. They've repeatedly been photographed and videotaped shooting guns at, beating, slapping, kicking, throwing stones and liquids at, verbally harassing Palestinian residents of Hebron, including women and children. And some dinner honorees have been documented supporting violence and terrorizing of the Palestinians. Hebron supporters support racial discrimination and also driving Palestinian residents out of Hebron from their homes. Then Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert commented at the time about Hebron, quote, "As a Jew, I was ashamed at the scenes of Jews opening fire at innocent Arabs in Hebron. There was no other definition than the term pogrom to describe what I have seen." And there was a recent protest at Citi Field with Code Pink, Jews Against the Occupation, Jewish Voice for Peace, and Allies Jews for Racial and Economic Justice. So it's very unfortunate that the Mets are having this kind of racism in, ironically, the Jackie Robinson Rotunda.
It's terrible. That's really terrible.
And two announcers of the NBA LA Clippers last night were suspended for comments about their Memphis Grizzlies center, Hamad Haddadi, harkening back to a lot of Islamophobia when former Denver Nuggets player in 1996, Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf, had stated that the American flag was a symbol of oppression and the United States had a long history of tyranny. He said that standing for the national anthem would therefore conflict with his Islamic beliefs. He ultimately would stand, but ultimately silently recited a prayer. So here's what the Clippers announcers did to get suspended. Quote, "Look who's in. It's Hamad Haddadi. Where's he from? I believe he's the first Iranian to play in the NBA. There aren't any Iranian players in the NBA. He's the only one. He's from Iran? I guess so. That Iran? Yes. The real Iran? Yes.
Oh my gosh.
Wow, Haddadi. That's H-A-D-D-A-D-I. You sure it's not Borat's older brother?
Oh, that's not even...
Oh, and it gets worse. If they ever make a movie about Haddadi, I'm going to get Sacha Baron Cohen to play him.
What?
There's Haddadi. A nice little backdoor pass. I guess those Iranians can pass the ball, especially the post players, because I don't know about their guards.
Whatever.
Yes, that kind of ethnic stereotype caused both of them to be suspended.
I mean, I'm laughing and chuckling out of just sheer disbelief. I don't know how else to respond.
Yes, that was
that kind of ignorance.
That was nationally broadcast, and the Clippers, and we'll be talking about the Clippers later on with better known owner, have suspended these two announcers temporarily. So that is your big progressive sports news of the week, and we'll be back in about a minute or two with our guests of Lori Serb and GEO talking about the education model here in Illinois at the University of California and beyond when it comes to funding.
And we're back with the second half-hour segment of Not Another Sports Show. I'm not sure why I'm clipping a little bit there. You're hearing me? Okay.
Yeah.
And this is the segment where we're going to talk with our special guests from the Graduate Employees Organization at the University of Illinois, and also talk about broader issues regarding funding priorities at public universities. So we have with us Caroline Napo and Lori Serb, both representatives from the Graduate Employees Organization. Thank you for being on our premiere episode.
Oh, thanks for having us.
So tell us about what happened. It's really exciting. I mean, I'm a member of GEO, for full disclosure, but let's just get the information out there.
I was going to say, this has been a big week for you, too.
It has indeed. No, very exciting.
So the GEO is the labor union at the University of Illinois that represents teaching assistants and graduate assistants. So those are the graduate students who work in teaching the classes, mm-hmm. And that can mean any number of things. TAs can run the gamut from grading papers and holding discussion sections and or teaching a class all on their own as the sole instructor. Mm-hmm. And we also represent graduate assistants, and those are people who work in different support services for the university. So graduate employees who work in like the counseling center, who work in some of the student union and some of those other campus resources. So we are the legal bargaining agent for graduate employees, and we typically negotiate a contract every 3 years. And we began bargaining for our third contract in April. We presented a full proposal to the university's bargaining team on the first day of bargaining, April 21st.
Mm-hmm.
And that included four pillars. The four pillars of the contract were tuition waivers, a living wage, increased access to childcare and parental rights, and also a full waiver of the student insurance fee, and increased participation in determining our healthcare package.
Okay.
The university didn't present a counter proposal until August, 3 days before our last contract was set to expire, which was August 15th. And we'd been meeting regularly since April. And of course, not only did the university shoot down every single one of our proposals, but in addition, they wanted to put several regressive measures into the contract, including furloughs.
Sure.
They wanted to erode grievance language. And they also wanted to make it harder for us to reopen the bargaining if anything happened to the contract, to change the working if working conditions changed.
Sure,
they
sure.
would have made it harder to reopen. So in any case, the university didn't actually come back with anything worth looking at until we started to threaten direct action. And so when we voted to file a document in October, I think that was when we had the general membership meeting, because members were talking about the possibility of having to go on strike mm-hmm. in order to get what we wanted. And the way that that works is first you have to do file some paperwork.
The intent to strike.
Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So it wasn't until we held the intent to strike vote and then went to file the paperwork that the university came back and actually started offering some decent proposals. But it still wasn't enough movement. And it was a week ago today that we were having basically a slumber party at the Institute of Aviation. About 350 members came out for a rally at an emergency bargaining session. At that point, we had already voted to authorize a strike.
Right.
And the way that it works under our Constitution is that the members, in voting to authorize a strike, technically what they're doing is voting to authorize the formation of a strike committee. And then that committee is empowered to call, plan, implement, or suspend a work action. And so we, after that bargaining session, which lasted about 6.5 hours, and we had about 100 members stick around for the whole time. The bargaining team came back, and the university had moved on everything except tuition waivers. They would not put language in the contract that would protect tuition waivers in a comprehensive way. Mm-hmm. The best they said that they could do was point to the Board of Trustees rules, which only protect in-state tuition waivers. Right. So that was. I keep noticing in a lot of the coverage over the past week that that this is referred to as the sticking point, and now I just feel compelled to say it, that was the final sticking point, was that...
it's hard to call it anything else,
yes,
right?
I mean, yes, and you know, even...
And what a strange thing to get stuck on, right? Because this isn't really anything that impacts how they would plan their budget, right? I mean...
Right, it's a non-monetary
exactly,
issue.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, really strange. So the strike started.
Well, so yeah, after that meeting, after that bargaining session, when the tuition waivers, we didn't get what we wanted, and we had heard from so many members over the last few weeks, and just increasingly, that tuition waivers was their bottom line. Mm-hmm. That anything else, they were willing to let it go, but tuition waivers mm-hmm. was the one thing that they cared most about and would be willing to walk out on. So yeah, around a 10:30 at night on Saturday, the strike committee voted wow. to call the strike for Monday morning, and there was of course some frenzied planning that occurred on Sunday, and then on Monday morning at 7:45 we had a rally on the quad, and then our members and our allies formed picket lines around the quad buildings. So that includes the English building, Davenport, the chemistry annex, Gregory Hall, mm-hmm. and the foreign languages building. We were not picketing Lincoln because it's closed for renovation.
Oh, sure, right.
And Follinger, we had, and so throughout the day, I think we had over 1,000 people on the picket lines, and we picketed for just a day and a half, actually, and then the university folded and then agreed on Tuesday morning's bargaining session to
yep.
put the language in there. I mean, they really, I think, painted themselves into a corner because, one, it's a non-monetary issue, so, and the fact that they were so stubborn about not putting the language in only made it seem suspect that if you're not going yeah. to change the tuition waiver policy, and I just thought that was really laughable, you know, that we would get these communiques from the provost or whomever saying, oh, well, we have no intention of taking away tuition waivers, so don't worry about it. And I just think, that's not why we have unions, because the boss tells you,
right.
oh, I'm not going to do anything that you won't like.
Their mass mails were laughable. I mean, they almost made your case for you, right? Like, there's
no way
we
exactly
could compete without tuition waivers, blah, blah, blah. Well,
yeah.
then put it in the contract.
yeah.
Yeah, that was pretty impressive. But I think... just for listeners that aren't aware of GEO, it has something like a 2,600 student membership, right?
Yeah, it's almost 2,700.
Almost 2,700, and this is something like close to a quarter of all of the undergraduate courses are directed by TAs on campus. If I remember the
statistics
correctly. That's correct.
Yeah, I've gotten really good at numbers for the past few months. I can just recite these things. Yeah, we teach. When I say we, I'm not a teaching assistant, but just
sure.
As you know, my consciousness as a GEO member. The GEO, yeah, our members teach 23.1% of all undergraduate
okay.
courses, and we teach, I think, over 40%, around 40%, if not more, of the survey courses, so the 100-level intro
sure.
courses.
Mm-hmm. So this is a pretty significant impact. I mean, this really, having Monday and Tuesday for a strike, I mean, that would be quite a few classes that just
yes,
didn't meet.
The English building was completely shut down, from what I understand. And we had several faculty in solidarity cancel their classes as well. I think every single history faculty member, except for one, canceled their classes, and we had an anthropology professor who canceled her class where she teaches an over 700 seat lecture course.
Wow. Okay. Well, I mean, that helps then, I guess, having that sort of support throughout the campus community. I mean, I guess that proves it why the strike only lasted a day and a half,
yeah,
I guess, effectively.
Yeah, and you know, and the other thing that the university, I think, where they also just made themselves look really stupid, I guess, is the only word, is that they lied about our bargaining session from last Saturday and said that the reason that talks fell down was that that tuition waivers were an 11th hour demand.
I remember seeing that in the statement, yeah.
And all you have to do is look at any coverage from the Daily Illini or the News Gazette from the last months to know that we've talked about tuition waivers every time that we have talked about what this contract is about.
I mean, if I recall correctly, that was one of the four pillars, right?
Yes,
I mean,
yes.
Since that language developed, I mean, that was like pillar number two or something like that.
So it was just silly. And I think that it also just showed that they really were grasping at straws and didn't have anything, you know, to say where they could really defend their position. So,
do you have any questions, Neil?
Yeah, I was just kind of reminded of the old reserve clause with this whole ideology of keeping these people, you know, under contract. For those who don't know, the reserve clause was an idea that you would be signed to a contract for one season, and once you finished out that season, you had no choice but to renegotiate that contract at whatever the boss wanted, or you wouldn't play baseball again.
Yeah, I mean, something similar sort of plays here too, right? I mean, there's sort of a dual nature with these workers. They came here to get a degree. They're students, but they also work for a paycheck. And I mean, as Caroline just said, you know, I mean, teaching almost a quarter of the classes, I mean, that's a really significant part of the university's mission. But they're almost like a captive audience, right? I mean, they want to stay and get their degree. At the same time, they want a living wage, and they want to be able to actually live here.
Right. I mean, we are an incredibly cheap source of labor, and even if we worked full time and were paid at the pay scale that we have now, mm-hmm. we would still be underpaid for that kind of labor compared to what faculty get paid. And of course, you know, what we have said is that we're not asking to be paid at the same levels as faculty. With the living wage issue, we have just said, pay us what you, the university, have stated is the minimum needed to live. And we've also tried to tie that into the current global economic meltdown, which has largely perpetuated because of debt. And mm-hmm. so when people aren't paid enough to live on, they go into debt. They take out loans, they put it on their credit cards. And so we see it as the university paying us a living wage is doing our part to stimulate the economy.
Oh, of course. Yeah, I mean, it's developing the consumer base. But there was an interesting point that you, or interesting detail that you had come up with, Neil, about the budget, right? Because the budget was a big issue for the university's bargaining team, you know, saying that they didn't have the money to support a living wage for people. But you found kind of an interesting discrepancy between their spending and their budgeted amount. Do you have the figures for that?
Yeah, I have a little bit of figures just nationally about the NCAA.
Yeah, yeah.
The NCAA had found out that among 90%+ of all Division I sports programs, which the University of Illinois is, and 75% of the Football Bowl subdivision programs, do not turn an annual profit. Per the NCAA as well, quote, only 25 Division I sports programs turned a profit in 2008, counting only their generated revenues, the study found, and only 18 had shown a profit consistently for 5 years. Here at the University of Illinois, they made about $1.9 million in money, spending about approximately $53 million and making approximately about $55 million. And unfortunately, that doesn't count all the money that they had to spend in to refurbish Assembly Hall, Memorial Stadium, because uh-huh. that is paid for by
student fees.
Student fees.
No, you gotta love it. They'll get the money any way they can, right?
As the Daily Illini call those student fees, quote, substantial. And in a sufficiently vague idea of what this fee is, it says on the website, quote, a fee comprised of debt service, facility renewal and replacement funds, campus administrative charges, and general university overhead charges, distributed to auxiliary service units like Assembly Hall, athletic facilities, campus recreation, the Career Center, Counseling Center, Illini Union, and so on. Now, debt service caught my attention because the U of I is, from what I can tell, is using this to pay off the debt service to the $121 million worth of bonds for the mm-hmm. renovation of Memorial Stadium.
Mm-hmm.
So the students are helping to pay for Memorial Stadium's refurbishments while their TAs don't get to make a living wage and we're being threatened with furloughs. Now, when I had called the University of Illinois to ask where these funds go to, public affairs could not tell me, and they called me back to tell me that they couldn't tell me where these monies went.
At least they called you back. I mean.
Yes, they were very nice on the phone, and they tried to direct me to the website I had already seen. They were very nice. But you know, this also fits into that wider framework, as I'm sure most of you have seen. The University of California is in complete rebellion right now over the raising of student fees over 32%.
Right, mm-hmm. and I think it's important to clarify that this when fees really means tuition, except that in the state of California they can't call it tuition because they were never supposed to have been charged tuition in the first place. It's much like the City University of New York system, CUNY, which originally was a free school. It's still more affordable compared to a lot of other institutions of higher education. But I just find that really, you know, tragically funny that.
Yeah, no, I remember. I think it was when Ronald Reagan was governor of California. He was the first one who made them all. Or they used to be free up to that point, I guess.
And the less said for me about Ronald Reagan, the better.
Oh yeah. Maybe for another episode.
So, exactly.
Okay.
Oh, I found out that the University of California, Berkeley, couldn't find the money to keep the libraries open 24 hours a day. And statistically, that would actually be 1% of what the chancellor used in his own discretionary funds to subsidize the California Golden Bears athletic teams.
Wow. That is interesting.
A family did finally donate the necessary money. And the University Golden Bear Sports Program is among those 90% that don't get to turn a profit. And in just recently, in the last week, California officials revealed that in 2007, the central administration forgave $31 million in previous loans to the athletic department to cover their deficits.
It's crazy. You know, I just have to wonder what the... You know, not to rip on college athletics or anything, but what's the point of this, really? It's not making the money. I mean, there might be a draw to bring in students, but...
I think the donor relations is a big part of it, because the university's giving... I mean, I know here at Illinois has gone up over in the last year, and I think that that's a big part of... I mean, that would be my guess.
Yeah, it could be, but even at that, you know, it's like some of those donations are sort of earmarked just for the athletics program. It's like its own little separate unit over here. No, I'm just throwing it out. I don't really have an answer, but it's just kind of curious what's up with that. And I mean, even in Division I athletics, you're looking at you know, some of these programs, the better programs, are getting maybe like a 50% graduation rate. You know, so we're not really getting committed students. We're not really getting a lot of money out of it. I just wonder, you know, where is this coming from? What's
Although to its credit, Illinois is graduating between 70% and 80% of its football and basketball scholarship students.
Okay.
They are one of the better ones
not
compared
to
other enough. Schools that are graduating under 30% of their athletes.
Okay, fair enough. I remember when I my first round in graduate school was at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and they had just gotten out of their, I guess that was, let's see, I started in 2000. I think in 99 they won the Rose Bowl. So they were really, you know, excited about that. And they were bragging about a 50% graduation rate for their football team. So, I mean, it was really just an NFL recruiting program, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, guys that go in there, get some experience, and then move on. So they weren't really committed students or anything like that. Which is sort of discouraging for a university whose mission is supposed to be, you know, especially a public university, supposed to be service for the people of that state and providing an education.
Well, even like this whole idea that sports subsidies isn't anything new. The vast majority of universities do this. The median football Division I A school provides $8.5 million in institutional funds, whether that's direct support or waived mm-hmm. utility costs and student fees. While the median private institution provides over $12.5 million in such funds. So this is something definitely to keep a lookout for, the use of student funds when it comes to sports. And we're not trying to rag on, you know, college football, because I love spending my Saturday afternoons watching college football.
That's fun to watch, man.
It is quite entertaining. You know, university basketball is another great thing. Like March Madness, you cannot tear me away from watching those basketball games. But it's kind of unfortunate that a lot of these schools are seemingly taking away from their academic missions to help provide for money for athletics and then say, well, there's no money left to help give people living wages.
And yeah, I think it was the football coach or the basketball coach last year at Illinois who got the enormous raise, like $500,000.
Okay, well, Zook, I guess, is keeping his current salary, right?
Yes.
At a modest $1.5 million a year.
Yeah.
Feeling the economic crunch, too.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, he went without a raise. Why can't those GAs and TAs go without one?
Well, I mean, it's amazing that someone in athletics draws a salary that's larger than the president or the chancellor.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
I mean, what does that say about the priorities of the university?
Absolutely, absolutely. He is, I believe, the highest paid employee in the U of I system, right, including Springfield and Chicago?
I believe so.
Yeah, just outstanding.
And I know his base salary is about $200,000.
That's
and
right.
And a lot of that other money comes from the Office of Intercollegiate Athletics. For instance, he gets $900,000 to do interviews.
Yeah.
Oh, I should have told you guys. That's my fee, too.
Oh. I left my checkbook at home. I'll get right on that, though.
Yes, my half is in the mail.
Anyway, Neil, you're supposed to check on this before.
So this idea about education funding and sports is directly related, so hopefully we're starting to make that point, and we'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Better Know an Owner.
And we're back. So this is going to be what we hope to be sort of a regular segment for our show, what we'd like to call Better Know an Owner, where we single out a particular club owner and just talk about him, talk about various details. So for today's episode, we would like to talk about Donald Sterling, who's the owner of NBA's Los Angeles Clippers. And apparently also a real estate mogul.
Yes, he owns over 115 buildings in Los Angeles.
So, okay, so he more than dabbles in real estate, I guess we could say. So in early November of this year, he settled a federal housing bias lawsuit for $2.73 million, a settlement that's being called one of the largest of its kind. he settled another housing discrimination lawsuit in 2003. And according to depositions given by one of Sterling's property supervisors that were obtained by ESPN, reporter Peter Keating, Sterling had an image for potential tenants. He didn't want blacks. He didn't want Mexicans. He didn't want families with children. He didn't want government housing subsidy recipients as tenants. According to these depositions, Sterling stated that, quote, all of the blacks in this building, they smell. They're not clean. All of the Mexicans sit around and smoke and drink all day. Children were, quote, brats. And he said, quote, I don't have to spend any more money on Koreans. They will take away whatever conditions, they will take whatever conditions I give them and still pay the rent. So I'm going to keep buying in Koreatown. According to tenants, Sterling's employees made life incredibly difficult. They refused rent checks and then accused minority renters of non-payment. They refused to do repairs for black tenants and harassed them with surprise inspections, threatening residents with eviction for alleged violations of building rules.
When construction work caused a serious leak at one of Sterling's 115 complexes, and property supervisors had witnessed tenants' belongings floating around them, Sterling's response was, quote, is she one of the black people that stink? And quoted that he would, quote, just evict the... instead of compensating the tenant for her ruined property. But he doesn't just stop there. According to ESPN, the magazine's reports, quote, a former employee named Christine Jaxie sued Sterling for sexual harassment. According to testimony Jaxie gave, Sterling touched her in ways that made her uncomfortable and asked her friends to visit friends of his for sex. Sterling also repeatedly ordered to find massage therapist who would service him sexually. He at one time paid a former associate multiple times for $500 for providing sex on multiple occasions. According to his former general manager, Elgin Baylor, Sterling wanted a, quote, southern plantation-type structure for the LA Clippers, which he allegedly told Baylor was, quote, poor black boys from the south playing for a white head coach. Now, Sterling had purchased the Clippers in 1981 for $13 million, and his franchise is now valued at more than $300 million. Under his leadership, the team has lost 50 games in a season 20 times. It should be noted, for those of you that don't know, there are only 82 games in a season. Sterling was once fined $10,000 by the NBA for suggesting that the LA Clippers should purposely lose to help their position in the draft. This would help keep players' values low. In order to keep players' values low, according to Deadspin, Sterling's scorekeepers during the late 1990s, quote, routinely and dramatically undercounted the Clippers' assist totals. Deliberate or not, this effect was to depress the value of the team's own players. And according to Franz Lids in Sports Illustrated, Sterling would refuse to add players even after injuries left the roster at the league minimum of 8. Quote, the Clippers came close to forfeiting a game after forward Michael Brooks had oral surgery, Lids wrote. Quote, Brooks had to suit up, and he actually played, though his jaw was as swollen as Sterling's ego. God. Lid's article even goes on to discuss Sterling refusing to pay a $1,000 prize for a free throw shooting contest, forcing the winner, who was a season ticket holder, to sue Sterling for the money. And according to Sports Illustrated, Sterling's also said to have proposed to trim the team budget for his second season by slashing training camp expenses from more than $50,000 to about $100, scouting from more than $20,000 to about $1,000, advertising for more than $200,000 to less than $9,000, and medical expenses from about $10,000 to $100.
So just a little cut there.
So, Donald Sterling, now you know about an owner.
Better know an owner. I think that's going to have to be a regular segment, Neil. Very interesting.
And there are actual LA tenants that are working together at NBAShowYouCare.com to try to punish Donald Sterling. Because David Stern, the commissioner of the NBA, has not said anything about Donald Sterling's efforts. However, this same guy has come out and demanded a dress code for NBA players because they dressed too street and too thug for his liking, and would constantly suspend and punish players who would happen to make fun of referees, argue about the conduct during games of referees, and once suspended a couple of players for an entire season a few years ago, just this past week was the anniversary of it, for throwing punches at a fan. And wow. Yet this guy pays out the biggest housing discrimination lawsuit in American history, and the commissioner says nothing.
What's the name of the housing realtor company, so people are aware that it's owned by him?
Is it just one?
I unfortunately don't know the name off the top of my head, but I know he owns 115 different complexes.
Wow.
Impressive. Impressive. And I believe that'll have to wrap up our first episode, unless you have something else to add, Neil?
I unfortunately don't have anything else to add, just that sports and politics do intertwine, and we're hoping to bring you that intersection every single week in locally and nationally in politics and sports.
Excellent. Well, I hope you enjoyed the show. Thank you, Lori and Caroline, for coming and talking about the GEO's victory, maybe we'll have you on again soon.
Sounds great.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
And this has been Not Another Sports Show on WRFU LP FM 104.5.
It's good. David, you can just go to automation. It's good.
Do you have an issue that you feel passionately about? Maybe it's helping the homeless, media reform, preserving the environment, empowering women, or promoting peace and human rights. At Community Shares of Illinois, we believe that you should be able to direct your contributions to the cause that is closest to your heart. That's why we represent over 80 nonprofit organizations that improve the quality of life in Illinois. You can earmark your donation to a particular group or make a general donation that will be shared among our member organizations. WRFU and the Independent Media Center are members of Community Shares. To make a contribution to Community Shares or find out more about what organizations we represent, please call 217-352-6533 or visit our website at www.communityshareslllinois.org.
You're listening to WRFU LP Urbana 104.5 FM. If you can hear us, you can be us. WRFU 104.5 Community Radio, homemade by the community, for the community.